Hello everybody, welcome to this podcast today. I am your host, Büşra Yalçınöz Uçan. I am currently a postdoctoral research fellow at the Department of Media and Social Sciences, University of Stavanger in Norway. And this podcast is part of my two-year postdoctoral study, which is funded by a Marie Curie Individual Fellowship Program. In this first episode and the next one, I will talk about my research and share some insights with you that I hope you will find interesting. My research is on the interaction between gender-based violence and digital technologies. It is titled as Safety and Resilience Through Digital Technologies in the Context of Gender-Based Violence. Before sharing the details of the project, I want to start by giving you a brief overview of my professional background, because this project strays into this background. Well, first of all, I am a feminist psychology researcher and a clinical psychologist. Since my grad school, I have been working on gender-based violence. My research particularly focuses on the lived experiences of women who have been subjected to different forms of male violence. I specifically look into women's experience of seeking safety from violence, their decision-making processes of disclosing violence, their experiences of reaching out to support and services, their processes of moving away from or escaping violence and achieving safety and well-being. In my research, I broadly use feminist intersectional approaches to make meaning of the stories shared with me and to offer an analysis of these stories. Feminist intersectionality allows me to look at the wider structures and see how women's individual experiences of violence are embedded within these structures, as well as how different women respond to violence differently, and how these responses are shaped by the broader context of their lives. So in this sense, I am particularly invested in understanding women's experiences of violence in the context of marginalization. This means asking questions like, how poverty and gender-based violence intersect in women's lives, or what are the specific challenges or barriers that, for example, migrant women encounter while seeking help from services, or how justice system particularly fail racialized or ethnic women. So this current postdoctoral project builds upon these experiences and understandings. As a gender-based violence scholar, I wanted to understand the potential of digital technologies promoting safety and well-being in the context of violent relationships, as well as the risks that technologies bring to women's lives. So in this project, my focus was on women's lived experiences of harm, safety, and well-being in the context of gender-based violence, and how these processes are mediated by technologies. Digital technologies mainly refer to things like smartphones, computers, tablets, the internet, mobile phone applications, or social media platforms. My choice over the focus on digital technologies has been inspired and informed by the feminist theorizations of technology-gender relationship and digital feminist advocacy frameworks. These perspectives address how technologies, while reflecting and reinforcing gender-oppressive discourses and attitudes, they can be simultaneously used in beneficial and transformative ways to counter gender inequalities and injustices. Regarding the transformative use of technologies, we see many examples around the world today regarding how women can use social media to speak out against injustices or inequalities they encountered or violence they are subjected to. Technological spaces can be platforms for women or other marginalized groups to look for information, raise their voice, share their stories, connect with supportive others, or seek some sort of justice. Furthermore, especially after the pandemic, we see that technologies are increasingly being used in service provision to the victims, survivors of gender-based violence. It is now almost always the case that gender-based violence-related organizations or services, governments, NGOs, have their websites where they share relevant information regarding gender-based violence and inform public about the available resources for women. These internet pages aim for awareness raising, providing correct information, and connecting women with support services. Or we witness new forms of technologies developed to facilitate women's access to information and foster their decision-making processes regarding disclosing violence and seeking help. There are, for example, phone-based safety planning or risk management applications where women can independently assess their risks and plan their exit strategies. All these mean that digital technologies provide some unique new opportunities to victim survivors to change their circumstances. So, building upon these research developments, my objective for the project was to explore the role of digital technologies in victim-survivors' trajectories of being subjected to violence, seeking escape, and building their safety. I conceptualized the gender-based violence technology interaction as a two-way cyclic interaction. That means the dynamics of this interaction, on the one hand, involves experiences of digital harm, where the perpetrators in women's lives strategically and intentionally use digital tools to control and harass women. On the other hand, it also addresses the ways in which women can use digital strategies to counter their experiences of harm by seeking information, connection, and support. And I should also mention that this study has been conducted in Norway. Norway presents a unique case for this study, mainly because of its wide-scale digitalization policies. So, what does this mean? In 2019, the Norwegian government released a very ambitious plan or strategy for digitalizing the entire public sector. Norwegian Labour and Welfare Administration is a good example regarding how such digitalization policies are implemented. This is a service all citizens use for welfare-related reasons, such as to get unemployment benefits, to apply for jobs, to get childcare benefits, among many other things. And the entire system is digitalized now, which means all the services are given through a central digital system. So the assumption is that these digital services contribute to equality among citizens. Services become more efficient and accessible and less bureaucratic. Well, is this really the case? When, under what circumstances, and for whom these promises become a reality in individuals' lives? Previous studies in Norway and worldwide show that certain groups of people, such as older people, migrants, or socioeconomically disadvantaged people, are left behind of this digitalization culture. This means that they experience inequalities in accessing and using these digital systems and services. And in this sense, factors such as language barriers, going through difficult life situations like unemployment or mental health issues, having limited understanding of bureaucratic and administrative processes, or low socioeconomic status, are shown to restrict people's access to such digital services. What happens when one cannot access to these services or use them effectively? This becomes a form of inequality. In this way, social and digital inequalities interact with each other. The ones who have less offline resources also become the ones who have less opportunities to access and use these digital systems. So, in a sense, social and digital inequalities often reinforce each other. My study hopefully adds to this knowledge, as it offers a situated and survivor-centered understanding of gender-based violence technology relationship. This research is based on a series of qualitative in-depth one-on-one interviews with a group of women who have experienced gender-based violence in their intimate relationships and practitioners working in gender-based violence-related services in Norway. The women I interviewed were clients of a domestic violence center. Majority of them were migrant women and coming from disadvantaged or marginalized backgrounds. The practitioners who participated in the study included case managers, organization executives, social workers, counselors, or psychotherapists. So the findings I will share during the rest of this podcast are based on my analysis of these interviews. Today, I will share some insights with you regarding the barriers and challenges that restrict safe and beneficial use of technologies in women's lives. While the primary focus of my project was to understand and explore the transformative use of technologies, the stories I collected almost always addressed the opposite. That means what the findings mainly showed was that during the course of seeking escape and safety from violence, which includes women's processes prior to separation and afterward, digital technologies were either absent in their lives or experienced as troubling and upsetting due to the control dynamics created by their violent husbands. Here, I want to describe an important concept, digital coercive control, which is introduced by Harris and Woodlock in 2019. The concept of coercive control describes a non-physical form of violence involving acts like humiliation, threats, intimidation. Through coercive control, perpetrators often aim to ensure control on the victims, isolate them from their supports, and increase their dependency. So, digital coercive control refers to the tactical and intentional use of digital tools by the perpetrators in the context of intimate relationships to further harass, intimidate, monitor, and control the victims. It restricts women's agency and freedom to enter and explore digital spaces. It limits women's participation in digital world. Digital coercive control has become a central concept in my study. Many women I interviewed talked about how their engagement with technologies were restricted or intensely controlled by their violent partners, and how this made them disconnected from the outside world. In a way, digital world or digital communication becomes inaccessible and threatening for women under the circumstances of digital coercive control. Here, I will continue with some examples from the stories I collected. Just as a quick reminder, the names I am using are not the real names of the participants. Maryam is a South Asian woman in her 30s. During her interview, she told me that when she first arrived in Norway, she didn't have a mobile phone and no other digital devices such as a computer or tablet were available at home for her use. This situation continued for 2 years, and then her ex-husband gave her an old used mobile phone. However, her use of it was strictly restricted and monitored by him. She says, I'm directly using her words here. He gave me a mobile phone after I got pregnant, but I wasn't allowed to do anything. Like, I had WhatsApp, but I only had my father's number in it. I couldn't have my sister's or my mother's numbers. I was only allowed to call my father once in a month, only for 5 minutes, and I had to put it on the speaker so he could hear us. I wasn't allowed to use social media, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, things like. Right here, I will continue with another example by Hannah. Migrant woman from West Africa. She was in her late 40s and she was a teacher in her country. What she shared with me is a direct example of digital coercive control. I'm reading a short part from her interview. He put a video camera in the house. I didn't have the freedom to even call somebody, my family, friends. It is to be recorded and used against you. I was in a tight corner. A Norwegian woman, Nora, who was a victim of severe physical, sexual, and psychological violence, shared with me that, I'm quoting her here, my phone had one function, to ensure control on me. I had to be available. Even if I was in a meeting, no reason was good enough not to answer, or it got violent consequences when I got home. So, these examples crucially show how digital control became part of the systemic violence that the women are subjected to. The perpetrators in these cases, like in many others, prevented women's ownership or their autonomous and free access to technologies, and this is intentionally done to isolate them further. The perpetrators managed to constrain women's autonomy and communication. By using digital control, they were able to create a shadow over women's sense of freedom, even in their physical absence. In a broader sense, what the women encountered was the near impossibility of autonomous and private access to and use of technologies. The interviews showed that digital coercive control directly targeted personal data and account privacy. For example, a practitioner I interviewed told me that, I'm quoting her own sentences, "You must give up your data. The perpetrators would just threaten women. Saying no is often impossible because it would lead to more violence. Then your partner can log into all your devices and accounts." So we can straight these observations into the extensive digitalization context in Norway and see how actually this context, when there is digital violence, may result in further alienation of women from social life. This becomes a distinct challenge for women because they become more and more disconnected from social and digital spaces, and the experiences of social and digital isolation reinforce each other. And when this happens, both offline and online resources become inaccessible, and this inaccessibility intensifies their conditions of entrapment in violent relationships. This is a situation commonly observed by the practitioners, as shared by one of them. She says, "When your partner controls how you use your phone, you become unavailable. This disconnects you from possibilities to engage in and reach out for help." Well, my intention in this research was to explore the potential of digital technologies to become empowering resources in women's lives. Yet, as I am describing, what I found out was that digital technologies played a very marginal role in women's processes of seeking escape and safety from violence. The internet is full of digital advocacy resources, online pages offering very useful information regarding violence, regarding what to do, whom to reach out to seek help or to find connections. Yet, my research shows that online information and help-seeking strategies were rarely used. It is often the case that due to the constant monitoring of the perpetrators, the women were left with slim chances, if any, to use digital resources without risking their safety further. Searching the internet, reaching out to relevant online information was not described as straightforward. Ella, a Norwegian woman who, after her separation from her violent husband, has become a very active online media user, explained that she encountered many barriers that made online information seeking either impossible or complicated for her while she was in her relationship. She said, "I wasn't allowed to access the internet. But even if you have the internet, it's not easy to find the right information because you don't have time. He constantly watches you. You have to be quick to search. Most women like Ella lack the freedom or luxury to invest this necessary time and effort to find correct sources of information. And trying to navigate the internet in such small windows of opportunity resulted in most women experiencing online information as fragmented, overwhelming, or confusing." So, based on these experiences, it can be said that there is a risk of assuming that online resources become automatically accessible or beneficial. Indeed, some practitioners emphasize the dangers of completely relying on digital resources as it would result in further isolation and blaming of victims. One of the practitioners, for example, said, I'm quoting him, "The danger of digitalizing everything is that it becomes like people don't need to talk to someone. They just have to read. But what people need is another person. People are also very likely to think that, oh, all the information you need is out there. So why you are not using these resources then?" So the women's experiences and the practitioners' observations indicate a gap between digital solution strategies and real-life offline supports. For example, many practitioners emphasize that most of their clients struggle to find online information about their services. And this is parallel to what women shared with me. None knew or has ever used such online resources before they separated from their partners. They often said that they preferred and benefited more from face-to-face supports. Shirin, an undocumented migrant woman, said, "The internet does not give you any courage. You need friends. You know about the rules, not the internet." Well, most of the examples I am providing in this podcast come from migrant women in Norway. Their experiences addressed additional challenges and barriers they encountered, which made their access to available online resources less likely. Language barrier emerged as a crucial factor, as one of the women, a young migrant mother, shared with me. "You cannot understand much from the internet. Especially when you don't know Norwegian, it's a waste of time. It doesn't give you anything." Intersecting with the language barrier, not having enough digital competence, unfamiliarity with the online systems in Norway, or not having access to properly functioning devices also emerged as overlapping challenges. Another migrant woman shared with me that, I'm using her words here, "My main problem is that information is hidden in Norway. I don't understand Norwegian a lot, and the words are too technical. So the assumption is that digital resources become much more useful and benefiting, especially for marginalized or disadvantaged individuals. But on the contrary, these findings, in alignment with previous research, show that digital technologies do not automatically increase the opportunities of hard-to-reach or silent groups to reach out to or access resources and to raise their voices in online spaces. So for all women, but especially for migrant women, the most important thing is to learn how the system works. What are the services? How they can reach out to such services? What are the phone numbers, email numbers? What are their rights? All in all, women victims of gender-based violence, migrant or not, need a roadmap to effectively guide their steps during their process of seeking escape and safety. And this is what is missing. So before finishing the podcast today, once more, I want to highlight the relevance of these findings to the digital transformation context in Norway. Digital participation, not only in Norway, but globally, has become increasingly central to everyday life. And what we see is that, in the context of gender-based violence and digital coercive control, and also in the existence of the additional intersecting barriers I just discussed, women are deprived of their basic digital citizenship rights in a society and system that is more and more digitalized. Digital coercive control restricts women's inclusion and belongingness, and this shows how gender-based violence becomes a crucial factor, reinforcing women's isolation and disempowerment across online and offline spaces. I want to conclude this podcast by emphasizing the need for proper legal and policy frameworks to address digital coercive control and its impact on women's lives and their digital participation. We cannot expect that digital solutions are going to work for everybody. The one-size-fits-all approach doesn't work here, as it doesn't anywhere. So then, what we need to ask is, what works for whom, under what circumstances, and how? Well, this is the end of this podcast episode. Thank you very much for listening.